Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for joining us tonight as we journey out to the fringe, the edge. It's been a stormy weekend here in the desert, but a fairly mellow storm compared to what many of you are dealing with tonight in other parts of North America. We had a sprinkling of rain and a blast or two of wind, a good enough excuse, though, to stay inside and listen to the radio. Tonight, we will travel out of our body, so to speak, or rather hear from people who've been in touch with some other realities. Not necessarily alien, but certainly hidden. Three guests coming up in 4 hours, and each one brings a unique perspective to our understanding of the world and ourselves. In the second half tonight, we delve into the world of dreams and dream states. What are dreams, anyway? And what, if anything, are they telling us about ourselves? Patricia Eltinge, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Patricia has spent about 25 years studying dreams, symbolism, interpretation of dreams, and the importance of figuring out what our conscious or subconscious mind are trying to tell us. The Dream Class is the title of her new book. Know Your Dreams, Know Yourself is the subtitle, and it is exactly what it sounds like, a tutorial in how to figure out what that crazy dream you had last night might mean. Just maybe it wasn't caused by the guacamole you had before bed. And we will be saving time for you to call in, maybe share some of your dreams to see if she can tell us what that might mean. So be thinking about it. And please don't give us the 30-minute-long recitation of that dream, no matter how crazy it might be. Before that, a very thoughtful and original view of contactee experiences and their relationship to weird synchronicities in people's lives, a glitch in the matrix, maybe. Mike Cleland was my guest last year, and he told us about the recurrent encounters he's had with what he thought were owls and what he learned about the underlying meaning. What he's figured out has had a profound effect on his life. His newest work is called Hidden Experience. It's a mind-bender of a book, and we are glad to have Mike back. But first, in a few minutes, we take a deep dive into spiritualism as seen through the lens of a talented photographer. Shannon Taggart has spent close to two decades investigating spiritualism, its connection to photography and art and personal freedom. Her book, Seance, is, in my view, it's itself a work of art. It's just gorgeous, and we've posted some of the photos online for you to check out. In fact, all three of these books we will discuss tonight are both provocative and visually appealing. And yes, I make no bones about it. We do encourage people to read. And by that, I mean books. Read books. Sometimes our attention spans, seem to be about as detailed and fleeting as, say, the last tweet we read. Taking the time to read a good book is a great way to slow down, take stock of where you are, where you want to be. So, yeah, reading books is a good thing, and we have three worthy examples of that tonight. Our webmaster, Lex Lonehood, and I have pulled together a collection of items and oddities of interest. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website, along with those seance photos just mentioned, and we have the story about the oldest cave art in the world, recently discovered, and what it depicts is telling. It depicts shapeshifters, supernatural hunters. Sure seems like humans have had an interest in the unknown for a very long time, and we still do. There's a second article there that looks at more recent accounts of what might be called shapeshifters or skinwalkers. There's also an older story that I overlooked when it first came out about how the internet is being used to create tulpas. You ever seen that X-Files episode? They're tulpamancers, they're called these days. We also feature a really cool piece about super trees, these enormous, gigantic denizens of the jungle, and all the good they do for us and for our planet. Great photos with that, too. And then a couple of UFO-related stories in light of the fact that tomorrow marks the 2-year date since the New York Times digital story, I think it was followed by a print version on the 17th, first told us about ATIP and the Tic Tac and Commander Dave Fravor and Lou Elizondo, all that, which of course, as you know, led to an avalanche of serious UFO coverage by mainstream media. It's still going on. Those stories and more in Knapp's News tonight. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day if you subscribe for a year. Gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs, including those Art Bell classics. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want. It's still a good deal. There's a similar good subscription deal available for George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which digs into many of the same topics and guests that we cover here. Check it out on the Coast website. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the pet duck. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into the flannel PJs and bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble in a moment. Shannon Taggart takes us along to her spiritual exploration, Seance. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. You know, after prepping this weekend for tonight's program and reading these three excellent books, I'm already regretting scheduling all three of our guests on one program. I think they each deserve their own interview, and our first guest is evidence of that. Shannon Taggart is a New York-based photographer whose work crosses and blurs the boundaries of art, anthropology, and the paranormal. Her works have been published in some of the world's best-known news publications. Her interest in spiritualism started back when she was a teenager, following the death of her grandfather. 18 years of work went into the book Seance, and it shows. It's beautiful and thoughtful piece of work. Shannon, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Can we start with the story about your grandfather and the message he sent, how that led you to where you are today?
Sure. So my grandfather died of what we thought was brain cancer, and that was just the family story. And my cousin went to Lilydale, which is the world's largest spiritualist community, and we all grew up nearby. And a medium there picked her from a crowd, and they have these services called message services, where you go and you just sit anonymously, and the medium stands in the front. And she'll pick people out of the crowd, she or he, and ask you if you will accept a message. And this woman picked my cousin out of the crowd and said, "Your grandfather's here, and he wants you to know he choked to death. That's really how he died." And my cousin said, "Oh, my gosh, this woman has got to be crazy." And she went home to laugh about it with her parents. And my father's brother, her father and my uncle said, "No, that's actually true."
Oh.
And so that it became the way that we knew this family secret, that he had actually had this accident in the hospital and had asphyxiated. And he had died, I think, 30 years prior. So it was rare information, and none of us knew it, and it was never talked about in the family. And so I just was very shocked by this. And my whole family, I remember being very shocked by this, and I just thought to myself, how could somebody possibly know this? How could a stranger know this?
So that's the spark that got you started, that interested in spiritualism.
Yes, and I was 14 years old when that happened, but I didn't investigate spiritualism until I became out of college and I was working as a professional photographer. I thought I'd spend one summer at Lilydale in this quirky little town and make like a cute little, you know, short photo essay about all these characters who I was meeting who were telling me they could speak with the spirits of the dead. And instead, I am 18 years later now compiling it into a book.
You know, spiritualism has a pretty bad reputation in many circles, not here necessarily, but, you know, there have been scams and shams and fortune tellers out to separate gullible people from their money. So what do you deal with when people approach, look at your book without even reading it and make a judgment about it?
Yes, that is the common perception, and I know that. And there have been documented cases of fraud, absolutely, throughout the history of spiritualism. But what I found was very sincere practitioners who were very obviously working in this way as mediums because they were called to do so, and they were looking to provide healing and just a link between this world and the next in order to create a healing, and they weren't making tons of money on it. And I found the exception was the fraudulent or the untrustworthy. That's been very, very rare in my experience who I've met. I've met a lot of very sincere practitioners.
You know, there are scam artists in banking and government and journalism and just about every other profession there is, too. So spiritualism would not be alone in that. And I meant that as in a good way. I mean, that, you know, humans are flawed. So just because there have been some bad ones doesn't mean all of them are bad. Your book has a foreword by Dan Aykroyd, who describes himself as a fourth generation spiritualist. He called your book a standard for all ghost hunters and students of the supernatural. That's pretty high praise. How'd you get Dan Aykroyd to do this?
I actually met Dan Aykroyd in Lilydale. He was there with his father, Peter, who wrote a wonderful book about spiritualism called A History of Ghosts, and that came out in 2009. So Dan and Peter and the rest of Dan's family were in Lilydale, and we happened to meet, and I was able to show him my photographs. And I really am a fan of Dan's father's book as well, so it's kind of really interesting to have I see my book kind of plays off of a lot of his work that he's done, and I was actually able to reproduce in the book one of their family spirit photographs, so that was really exciting.
You know, you dedicate the book to your mother, and although you say in the dedication that you make an oblique sort of reference that she's come back many times, I assume in sessions that you've had, I don't remember seeing it in the text of the book itself. So do you want to talk about that at least a little bit?
Sure. Yes, I've had I've had a number of messages from my mother, but one of the most dramatic one was from my friend Lauren Thibodeau, who's a Lilydale medium. And shortly after my mother died, my brother and my sister said, "Oh, we're going to get a tattoo for Mom," and I was kind of just really shocked and out of it, and I just thought, "Oh, okay, whatever." This is like right after she passed. They said this to me. And then the next morning, I get a text from my friend Lauren, and she said, "Well, you're going to think I'm crazy, but your mom already came to me," and she gave me this long text about what my mother was describing on the other side, and at the end of the text, it said, then she said, "Please tell them no tattoos," and she started laughing, and then she took off like a hummingbird.
So this friend who sends this message, "Don't get a tattoo," there's no way she knew that you were talking about getting a tattoo, or did she?
No. She was in another city. She didn't. There was no way she could have known that. I had even forgotten, you know, in the shock of it, I hadn't even, you know, they had told me that, and I didn't tell anybody that. So it was just, for me, it was very comforting and very compelling, and one of those beautiful moments where you really are compelled to wonder what exactly is happening.
Discussing spiritualism, you refer to fringe uses of photography and how these so-called fringe uses have really had an impact on the development of photography. So this, you have dual interests here, not only interested in spiritualism for personal reasons, but as your profession as a photographer, you study what it meant to the early days of photography. Discuss that a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. When I began my project, I had no idea that spiritualism had a very rich photographic history. And this was not written in any of the photography textbooks I studied from. It was the spiritualist in Lilydale who taught me about this history. And I was shocked and could not believe. I mean, I find the history of spirit photography and spiritualism using photography is one of the most dramatic and strange moments in all of the history of photography. And to realize that the early spiritualists were trying to prove spiritualism by using photography, and that through this dialogue, they actually ended up exposing a lot of the limitations of each practice. You know, I mean, trying to photograph spirits in seance rooms was not scientifically successful, but it was actually revealed a lot about each practice and the meaning and the limitations with each. I like to say that spiritualism and photography exposed each other. And so this early history was very rare. to find in books. And now it's more common to know about this visual history. And I like to say that spiritualism was the first religion that created its own iconography through photography rather than painting. They're like religious icons of spiritualism. You can see the teachings within these early experimentations. They're mostly done in the spirit of science, trying to prove it.
I was going to say, I mean, the examples you use of these early practitioners, they were men of science and with doctorates in front of their names.
Oh, yes, the list of Nobel laureates who investigated spiritualism is a mile long. It's really funny because early on in the project, I brought my portfolio into a science magazine, and, you know, I always show personal work along with my professional portfolio, and the editor said, oh, this is a publication about science. Why would you even bring this in here? And the funny thing is that some of the best scientific minds were completely fascinated by spiritualism and were spiritualists or investigating it. This includes the Curies, who table-tipped with the famous medium Giuseppe Palladino. Charles Richer, the man who coined the term ectoplasm, was a Nobel laureate in medicine. The list of scientists, it's pretty incredible.
I had never thought about this before reading your book, but how democratic photography is. Because if you wanted a likeness of some family member before photography, you have to pay somebody to paint a portrait or something, which not everyone can do. And so photography sort of made it more available, imagery like this, more available to the masses. And now we have cell phones that take selfies all day long. I had never looked at it in that way.
Yes, and the connections between spiritualism and photography, there's a lot of really deep and intrinsic connections. Like, for example, the very first public seances in the United States happened at Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York, literally down the same street from where Kodak would build its headquarters in 1888. So the photography and spiritualism were brought to the masses, were brought to the public, right, like next to each other, buildings very shortly down the same street.
And not to get too political, but the first photo in the book is of suffragettes. And I'm looking at this thinking, wow, that's a really interesting photo, but what's it got to do with this? And then you tell me what it has to do with this.
Yes, so spiritualism was deeply important to the women's rights movement. At a time, it was very dangerous for women to speak in public, and spiritualist camps and churches would allow women to speak in public. And the picture you're speaking of goes with Dan's foreword, and it's of suffragettes, including Susan B. Anthony, hanging out at Lilydale, because Lilydale was a hotbed of progressives and abolitionists and suffragettes, and people like Susan B. Anthony and Margaret Sanger also participated in Women's Day events later on. And the picture shows the suffragette Marion Skidmore holding a flag that says that the first two states had given women the right to vote. And spiritualism was deeply important to the women's rights movement.
Because it gave them a platform to speak in public, to have a voice, whereas I guess in some states they weren't even allowed to at that time.
Yes, it was frowned upon, dangerous. Women were really risking getting pelted with fruit or worse if they got on stage. The scholar Anne Brody wrote a really wonderful book called Radical Spirits about this history. And in the preface, she states about how her colleagues were really upset with her when this book came out in 1989 because they were embarrassed by the fact that spiritualism was attached to the women's rights movement.
Let's talk about Lilydale for a moment. We're going to go to a break in about a minute. But Lilydale, I guess you compare it to sort of the Vatican for spiritualism.
Yes, yes. The historian Ron Nagy at Lilydale always says, as Rome is to Catholicism, Lilydale is to spiritualism.
And hundreds of people have been practitioners there. Why there?
Spiritualism originated in upstate New York, outside of Rochester, and it just happened, there was like a summer area where people would go in the summer. Lilydale was kind of like a camp town, and then it ended up evolving into a cottage town, and now it's a hamlet where 400 people live.
And is it just a circumstance that it ended up being the capital of spiritualism, or is there something about that place?
That nobody really understands why so many religious movements erupted in upstate New York in the 1800s. It was called the Burned Over District, and that's where Mormonism and Seventh-day Adventism happened, a number of utopian communities as well. But people theorize that it might be, all the water nearby, like Niagara Falls and all the Great Lakes. There's theories that water is a great conductor for paranormal activity.
Oh, yeah.
I've
We have to go to a break now. We're talking with Shannon Taggart about her excellent book, Seance. We're talking with Shannon Taggart about her gorgeous new book called Seance, filled with photos that are pretty unusual. So, in the next segment, we're going to get into talking about what they show, whether they're legit, and also the question of spiritualism. When you open yourself up to whatever is out there, do you put yourself at risk that something sinister or bad comes in? I'm going to ask her about it in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Shannon Taggart, photographer, talking about her book, Seance. Of course, Shannon, you must have heard the argument about spiritualism. When you do this stuff, you open yourself up to evil spirits, bad omens, demons, whatever. What do you think about that?
Yes, I get this question a lot. Well, I would say that spiritualists, they don't consider themselves occultists or magic practitioners or aligned with other practices that you might be more susceptible to. They're really just trying to, they have a very strict boundaries on what they're actually doing, and they're just trying to open up communication between, this is how it's put to me. They're just trying to open up communication to prove that we don't die, that life goes on, that there is an afterlife, that your loved ones are still out there. So they're just trying to make that connection to bring healing into the world. So they're not trying to do prophecy or change material reality. I had somebody call me up and say, "Can you find me a necromancer?" And I had to explain, necromancy is not spiritualism. Spiritualists consider themselves Western rationalists who are, and they consider spiritualism a religion and a science, and they're trying to bring those two things together. People criticize that effort or see it in other ways, but that's how spiritualists define and see themselves. And as for protection, they believe their intention is part of their protection. They're also protected by their spirit guides that they work with. They kind of describe them as gatekeepers that keep them safe in their consciousness. And this is a controversial topic, though, and a lot of people ask me about it.
There are surprises, though, about what comes in, even no matter how good your intentions are. We have a colleague, a friend of ours, Leslie Kane, who wrote a book about surviving death, that something in us goes somewhere else and that it is possible to communicate. Thomas Edison, Tesla, they were trying to communicate with that. But that sometimes in her experience, and maybe in yours, you're looking to communicate with somebody in particular over there, and somebody else entirely comes through.
In a development class one time, I saw they had a woman, and she was speaking in trance, and she started bringing through something negative, and the mediums stopped it immediately and pulled her out and made her leave. And so the mediums that I work with describe it as that they are expert at controlling their own consciousness and who gets in and who gets out. Now, whether that's true or not, that would be have to be debated by them, but that's how it's described to me.
But I
That
mean,
it is
examples of
really.
like you're trying to get to your mom and your Uncle Joe comes through, something like that, with a message from your mom, often kind of humorous.
And I mean, I guess the difference between spiritualism and other practices, I would say, is spiritualists open their consciousness to see who comes through, who has something to say, rather than going and saying, they'll never say, "Oh, I can get your mother." They'll always say, "I don't know who's going to come in. I'm going to accept whoever has something to say." So that's one of the distinctions. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's tricky, and I'm not a medium, so I can't describe all the mechanics, but that's how it's described to me. And it is a controversial topic. I do know protection is, spiritualists say that they are evolved and that they've raised their level of awareness and consciousness very high, and that's how they're working. And other practitioners say, no, they're being naive. I've heard both. But the spiritualists, they describe it to me as their practice is their protection.
Let's talk about photos. So clearly there have been phonies in this field who have rigged their photos, used double exposure or other techniques, make them look spooky, make it look like there are entities there that weren't really there. And as I was looking at some of the photos, it occurred to me, about crop circles. I don't know if you know anything about crop circles, but most of the ones that are made these days are made by people. Some of them are sort of mysterious, but some people are drawn to this. To labor in obscurity and make these amazing formations and fields, and I don't even know that they're sure why they're drawn to it. And I wonder if some of that takes place here, that people who have created these photos that are not exactly what you'd call legitimate do it for reasons that they don't exactly understand.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I think initially, early on in spiritualism, they were genuinely trying to photograph phenomena in order to prove it as scientific. And the experimentation was actually very extensive. And when we learned about the photographic reality and that a picture doesn't always represent reality in the way that we think it does, I mean that there are things like double exposure and shutter drag and all of that, those things. Once we learned that, people dismissed spiritualism and photography, all the early spiritualist photography, and a lot of it does look beyond hokey. And some spiritualists say, oh, it's all fraudulent. Some argue that some of that stuff is real. That's not really what I became inspired by the strangeness of those visuals, and as an artist tried to play with their symbolism that came through in those in that early photography. So I am actually playing with the idea of what you can do with photography and what is actually happening. And by embracing photography's messiness, I've had a lot of strange synchronicities happen.
So, describe some.
So one time I was in a early on in the project, I was really unsure on how you make a picture of an invisible presence speaking to a visible body. And so I was at that time working very journalistically and very straightforward. And I was trying to make a sharp picture of a woman. We were in a séance and she was holding a red light. And we were all supposed to look at her and say and see what we were seeing, if we were seeing any spirits near her. And everybody in the room said, oh, I see a spirit right next to your face. It looks like you, but it's not you. Maybe it's your grandmother. Maybe it's your etheric body. Oh, no, it's that voodoo priestess, Marie Laveau. And I was not seeing this second face floating next to this woman's face. I was seeing a woman holding a red flashlight. And I tried to make a picture of that. And when I got my film back, I was shooting film at the time, on the image was a second face right next to her face, very peacefully floating there, that looked like her, but a little bit different. And it was this beautiful synchronicity. My camera shutter had accidentally made a picture that spoke to the clairvoyant experience that everybody else in the room was having. And so things like that. And I actually end the book with one of my strongest photographic synchronicities, which is a man in trance. And he looks totally transformed. And he had taken me to his house to show me a picture of his great grandfather. And it definitely does look, they definitely do look alike. And I don't know, that's, so I'm kind of playing with the mystery of photography and the mystery of spiritualism.
There's a line of advice in the book that suggests to seek contact with spirits, not ghosts. What's the importance of that message?
Yes. So spiritualists distinguish spirits from ghosts. Spirits have an intelligence and can communicate and have a consciousness, where ghosts, they kind of describe them as more like video or, like tape, like energy, you know, like a tape that plays over and over again. It's just something that's kind of stuck. It's a presence. It's a piece of the past that is stuck in a place. And so, like, often when ghost stories, you'll, it'll be like you'll try to talk to the ghost and the ghost doesn't talk back. And that's because it's a ghost, not a spirit. You know, you'll hear the ghost stories of the same woman in the same outfit walking down the hallway, the same hallway, things like that. That's how they distinguish it. It's the consciousness.
There's something called Project Alice referenced in your book. And one of the photos that shows up from Project Alice looks like an alien. And interdimensional, I think you called it in the book. What do you make of that one?
That's from a popular seance group from England in the 90s called the Skoll Experiment, which is an absolutely fascinating story. I highly recommend anybody who's interested to look into that. Robin Foy was one of the architects of that project. And so Project Alice was, the Skoll Experiment started using cameras and video cameras and regular cameras and audio recorders to try to connect with the other side. And their spirit guides told them to create this loop with video cameras where they were actually, the video cameras were both faced into a mirror. And so they were actually recording just a loop. And through that, they got this fantastic imagery, and some of it was alien. And now this is where it gets complicated in spiritualism, because spiritualists only seek contact with spirits of the dead. They have strict boundaries about communication with aliens or other entities such as angels or archetypes or other and anything that did not exist as a human who lived on Earth. So the Skoll Experiment had to leave spiritualism and become completely independent because they wanted to seek this contact with aliens and other realms.
You have some warnings, or at least words of caution, in the book about people who profess to be able to contact celebrity spirits. And Louis Armstrong, I'm surprised he plays a big role in this, but talk about the seeking of celebrity spirits, people who want to talk to celebrity spirits, and whether any of them, in your judgment, have really come through.
Yes, that was one of the most surprising things that I discovered, was that celebrity spirits were popular in seance rooms. And yes, Louis Armstrong, in my time in England, he's one of the most popular celebrities, along with Freddie Mercury. And Michael Jackson has become quite popular as well. And a lot of people, the minute they hear a celebrity is in the room, they become completely suspicious. and so I have a lot of funny quotes about that. But the weird thing is that celebrity spirits have played an enormous part in spiritualism's history. Since the Fox sisters, who were the early pioneers of the movement, it was Benjamin Franklin was the big celebrity of their day. And he was coming into a lot of seances and writing forwards to books and all of this stuff. So today we have a different number of celebrities. Elvis is quite popular as well. And yeah, I have a bunch of funny stories about my encounters with celebrity spirits in seance rooms in the book.
Well, we'll talk about Elvis in a moment, but I would just like to say that Ben Franklin would be high on my list right now, whether it's popular or not. Elvis. So there's a funny story you tell in the book about Elvis showing up at some seance, and the guy just won't stop talking. People are ready to, hey, Elvis, we got to move on here. They're looking at their watches, sort of a thing.
Yeah, and the medium kept saying, "Oh, I'm not gonna. This isn't Elvis," or "I'm not talking." She was kind of saying, "This can't be Elvis," and kind of said, "Just go away," and tried to make him go away three times, and then finally she said to the client, "Elvis is here, and he just won't go away." And it turned out that the woman's mother had been his housekeeper in Graceland, so medium, again, it was Lauren Thibodeau, my friend from Lilydale. She says, well, you know, celebrity dead is still dead. We talk to dead people, and sometimes, you know, you do get celebrities. So she's kind of saying sometimes it's legit when they bring through celebrities.
There's a letter, a photo of a letter written by Elvis in, I think, 2013 in the book.
Yes.
Is legit?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a fascinating woman named Myra Bassey, and she lives in England. And she said shortly after Elvis died, she started getting transmissions from him. And she goes into a trance state and puts her hand out on a table, and a pen just like lightly balances on her hand. And she starts writing as Elvis in handwriting that actually does look like his handwriting. And she has hundreds of these transmissions, and she saved them all. And in almost all of them, Elvis is coming to tell us that life is a school for the living, and we should make the most of our time here, and that death is just a transition. And you know, I was fascinated by her work, and then I discovered that Raymond Moody, the psychologist who coined the term near-death experience, wrote an entire book about Elvis and the afterlife, because he had collected a ton of stories during his research of people who've had interactions with the spirit of Elvis, and it's an absolutely fascinating book.
Yeah, we know Dr. Moody well. You reference orbs. So there's at least one photo in your book of what appear to be orbs. And I was just wondering, as a photographer, what you make of orbs, because, you know, there are those who just say that's dust particles that are illuminated by the flash of the camera or something like that, and not anything more.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a lot of very valid technical, reasons for orbs. But what I discovered is that, and then there's a physicist, Heinemann, who wrote a book about was able to get orbs in a clean room. What I found with the orb practitioners is that what the orb is actually besides the point. It's about interacting with the orbs. So when people do orb photography, they do this technique called orb calling, where they'll ask the orbs to come in and, or appear in certain patterns or appear exactly on their hand. And I've seen this over and over again where they will get the room to fill up with orbs, or they'll get an orb right over their hand. And again, is this a synchronicity? Are they really working with the consciousness that's appearing with orbs? Is this just dust? I don't know. I rarely get orbs, although I do have a funny story about I went to Italy and I was at a conference and I met some orb photographers and they said, "Oh, you know, let's go and do an orb experiment." And I said, "I'll bring my camera, but I'm not going to get orbs because I rarely get them. I have a large sensor. My flash is high above my lens. I don't have the normal things that make you more likely to get orbs." And they said, "No, when we go into the mountains and we say our prayers, you will get orbs." So I went with my camera, and I have the picture in the book. I did take a picture of orbs right after they said their prayers. And it's one of my only orb pictures I've ever gotten. And the file is orb upon orb upon orb. Every single centimeter of this file is filled with orbs. And it's a mystery to me because it wasn't a dust storm and there weren't a lot of bugs and it wasn't raining. So I don't know.
There are some photos of bent cutlery, knives and forks and spoons and things that are bent. And when I saw them, I was thinking immediately of Uri Geller. And then later in the book, there's a photo of him, I guess, at this location. Was he there? Did he visit the?
Yeah, actually, there was a woman who lived in Lilydale, who used to bring him into the area. Like she would fly him over, and he spent time in her home. And there's this huge collage she made in honor of Uri Geller that hangs in the Lilydale Museum. And in one of the pictures, it's her and Uri, and it has a little sticker that said, "I had to ask Uri to leave my living room because he was making all those silver bend by itself." But yeah, it's unclear exactly how the utensil bending got into spiritualism, but it's likely through Uri. And I was able to actually track that direct connection, and he has been very helpful and answered all of my research questions. So I think it's likely that Uri inspired a lot of that. Although there are mediums who said they were doing that stuff early on. But in spiritualism, they don't believe that that's actually paranormal. They see it more as a mind
Psychic.
over matter technique for
Right.
them. They're not bending it in the same way that Uri is. They're meditating on it and saying, when it feels ready to bend, bend it. And then they physically actually bend it.
Shannon Taggart, Seance is a beautiful book. I enjoyed it immensely. I'm looking for an excuse to have you come back so we can explore this in greater detail. And I hope this doesn't affect your career as a photographer and working with news organizations. But thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
We'll do a longer version of it next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Hidden Experience with Mike Cleland.